Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello and welcome to ID the Future. This is Annika Smith with the CSC in Seattle, and today we're going to talk with Casey Luskin about the recently released National Academy of Sciences booklet on evolution. Casey, thanks for agreeing to sit down with me today and having this interview. Let's get started. This is the third edition of the NAS booklet on evolution. What can you tell us about the history of the first two booklets, the story behind how the NAS got going with this and why?
Well, yeah, as you said, Annika, this is the third edition. The first edition was actually titled Science and Creationism. It was published in 1984, and it's much thinner than this current version. The second edition was published in 1999, same title, Science and Creationism. And this third edition was now published in 2008, and it's titled Science, Evolution, and Creationism. And what's interesting is to see what this issue, what this booklet has said over the years, and the impact that it's had. Interestingly, in 1984, the first edition very strongly promoted what you would call the NOMA model of science and religion, that science and religion are completely separate realms that do not interact with one another. And it's really clear that from the very beginning, the National Academy of Sciences had an agenda with this, that they were trying to target religious people, trying to tell them that there is no conflict between evolution and religion. And you would think that if the evidence for evolution was compelling and, you know, there was no conflict, then perhaps public skepticism of evolution in the U.S. would have dropped after such a prestigious body like this, actually releases kind of statements. Well, it turns out that after the first one was released in 1984, I think public skepticism of evolution was around, 90%, 89%. That didn't change hardly at all until the second one was released, where public skepticism of evolution was still around, 85 to 90%. And lo and behold, the second edition said the same exact kind of things. There is no conflict between evolution and religion. We have all this evidence supporting evolution. And now in 2008, they've released the third edition, hoping to, again, make a dent in public skepticism of evolution. And guess what? Today, public skepticism of evolution remains very high, well over 80%.
And just to remind our listeners, where did the NOMA model come from?
Well, it's been around for a long time, Annika. One of the most famous popularizers was Stephen Jay Gould,
right,
who wrote a very fun little book to read called The Rock of Ages. It's a fun book. I've read it a couple times. You can read it in a short evening read. And Stephen Jay Gould, who himself is not a religious person, is apparently an expert on science and religion and tells us that science and religion do not interact. Now, of course, Gould's model, the NOMA model, has been harshly critiqued by both many scientists and many scholars of religion who have said, well, sure, they do have different focuses, science and religion, but the fact of the matter is that they do overlap. But, this is really all beside the point. I mean, I think that there are plenty of people out there who have found ways to reconcile evolution and religion. The real issue here is that public skepticism of evolution has not dropped because the scientific evidence used to support evolution, especially as it is put forth from the elite scientific body in the U.S., in these booklets is very unconvincing. I can tell you from my personal experience, that is what happened to me. I first read the first edition, the 1984 edition of Science and Creation, when I was an undergraduate at UCSD. I think if you go back and you find that at the edition at the UCSD library, you'll see it was checked out a bunch of times between 96 and 2000. A number of those were on my library card. I read it numerous times, and what I found was quite interesting was that this booklet was very unconvincing. The evidence that was used to support evolution was what I would call very bland and very weak, easily rebuttable from those who are knowledgeable about the scientific critiques of evolution coming from people like Philip Johnson and scientists like Michael Behe and other scientists who were not even proponents of intelligent design that I had read when I was in college.
Right.
And then when they came out with the 99 edition, right before I ended my undergraduate studies at UCSD, I read that. And the evidence was full of misrepresentations of intelligent design. People who were actually informed about what intelligent design said and what the issues were at stake realized that there was a lot of huffing and puffing and bluffing on the part of the NAS. And so really, I think the reason why these sorts of statements from the elite scientific organization in the U.S. have not made any dent whatsoever in public skepticism of evolution is because the evidence just isn't on their side. And what they're trying to do is distort the evidence. People are familiar with the evidence will know that it's not, this is not correct. And I think we'll get into that more, I hope, before the podcast is over.
So this isn't the first time you've dealt with this issue. been.
Oh, by no means. As a matter of fact, I think I wrote two papers on the second edition of this booklet when I was doing my undergraduate and graduate studies for classes, and I had to write decent papers to pass the class. So I do know a bit about this. Yeah.
So you can compare these past two versions with this third edition. Are there any differences in this third edition? Any improvements, any changes, anything major? And why would they come out with a third edition now to update?
Well, the third edition, I think as you said earlier, just came out about 2 weeks ago. Why did they come out with it right now? I don't really know. It does seem on average they come out with a new statement about every, 8, 9, 10, 12 years, something around mm-hmm. those lines. So, I mean, they are essentially due for a new edition. This new edition is significantly larger and thicker than the previous ones. It seems almost like they combined some of their materials from their Teaching About Evolution and the Nature of Science booklet, which is a different booklet that just deals with how to teach evolution.
Okay.
To give you some of the highlights or improvements of the third edition, one of the first ones that jumped out to me was that the third edition left out a statement that was in the second edition that I would consider to be a bald-faced untruth. The second edition stated that, quote, "The question has become which of many pathways might have been followed to produce the first cells." And they're talking about the origin of life here. Which of many pathways? Well, I didn't know that there were many pathways that were known to produce the first cells. As a matter of fact, you can read that many honest, Darwinists even have admitted that there is no theory, complete theory for the, or complete pathway to explain how unliving chemicals formed the first living cell,
right,
or even the first, just merely a first self-replicating mm-hmm. molecule. And I understand that there are a lot of ideas out there, but none of them are even remotely close to being a complete explanation. Mm-hmm. And all of them have very serious criticisms that have been raised. And that's why there is no consensus on this issue. They don't have a working model. So I can, I'm not making this up. You can read this in many science writers, many scientists have acknowledged that there is not an explanation for the origin of life yet from science. And of course, that's okay. It's okay if science doesn't have an explanation. And it's okay to do research trying to find explanations. What the National Academy of Sciences did in its second edition is they basically told a little white lie to the public, saying that there are many pathways, quote, many pathways that, that are known. But there are not many pathways. There's not even one complete pathway to produce a living cell from non-living chemicals. So in my view, it was a very good improvement that that statement was actually left out of the third edition. And, we should not miss the fact that it was left out of the third edition. They didn't remove it for no reason. They removed it because they probably knew they were going to get called on it, if they left it in there. Now, what's interesting is that the third edition then keeps in some material from the subsequent paragraphs in the second edition. The second edition knows that the public is skeptical of the origin of life. They know that this is a weak point for Darwinian evolution. And so the second edition of the next paragraphs are full of statements which are supposed to reinforce your faith and the ability of science to resolve intractable problems. Let me read a quote. Quote, "The history of science shows that seemingly intractable problems like this one may become amenable to solution later as a result of advances in theory, instrumentation, or the discovery of new facts," unquote. Well, we find essentially the same language in this third edition, where as soon as the NAS confronts the fact, and they're a little bit grudgingly, open about the fact that there are some unsolved questions about the origin of life in this third edition, but they immediately then launch into this attempt to bolster the public's faith in science, that science will solve this problem. Now, I don't have any problem with scientists doing origin of life research. I think they should do it. But the fact of the matter is that the history of science, it doesn't just show that sometimes science can solve what were seemingly intractable problems. It also shows that scientists often abandon avenues of research that are not fruitful and that are not producing results. And the fact of the matter is that we've been doing origin of life research for well over 50 years now, and we don't even have a working model. I think that perhaps, we should be very careful and cautious about saying that science will one day come up with an answer to the origin of life. We don't know that. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. But it's clear what the NAS is doing here is they're trying to put the public's faith in science to solve this problem. It's not about the evidence. It's about increasing faith.
Very interesting. Can you tell me, is this the first time the NAS booklet has mentioned intelligent design by name?
No, the 99 edition mentioned intelligent design by name. It lumped it as creationism, and it called it a supernatural explanation. In some of the critiques that I wrote for the classes I took when I wrote a paper on this in my undergrad, I pointed out that that was a blatant misrepresentation of intelligent design. Intelligent design, back then in 99, is very clear for my deep proponents that intelligent design did not try to address questions about whether the designer was supernatural. Well, the 2008 edition is even worse. I mean, what was implicit or sort of, just sort of passingly stated in the 2000 or the 99.9 edition. In the 2008 edition, they actually repeatedly use the phrase intelligent design creationism. They make these blind statements, assertions as if it's just an accurate terminology that it's intelligent design creationism, not trying to make any distinguishing between intelligent design and creationism, which always refers to the supernatural and which is always based upon some kind of a religious text. They never actually get into the fact that intelligent design does not try to address questions about the supernatural or the divine, and they also never make it clear that intelligent design does not rely upon any type of religious text to make its arguments. And so they're purposefully and blatantly conflating ID and creationism throughout this booklet. And I think that people who are familiar with the actual arguments of ID proponents will see right through this. I mean, this is actually a wonderful case study in Darwinist propaganda. You won't find it better packaged anywhere than in this booklet. It's all right here within the span of 89 pages. You can get it all. I highly recommend people read it if they want to know what the other side says. And people who are familiar with what ID actually says will immediately see that, okay, they're having to twist ID to make it something that it's not.
Right, and this booklet is available for free download, correct?
Yeah, it is available for free download. And I think that's to the NSS's credit. They're not trying to make money off their propaganda. They just want it to go out to the public. And that, like all good propaganda.
So from the 1999 booklet, which basically sort of mentioned ID in passing, this 2008 edition, it seems to concentrate a bit more of a focus, is that right, on intelligent design, or more of an attack?
It definitely does. It basically uses the Judge Jones said it, we believe it, that settles it approach to intelligent design. It actually has some excerpts and some quotes directly from the Kitzmiller versus Dover ruling. And of course, you know, I think that's not unexpected, given that a federal judge has weighed in on intelligent design. But, of course, they provide no discussion of where Judge Jones might have been wrong. For example, the quote that they give from Judge Jones actually explicitly says that ID has produced no peer-reviewed literature. And those who listen to the ID of the Future podcast are familiar with, you know, much of the criticisms of the ruling we put out have made it clear that that is a black and white issue that Judge Jones simply got wrong. So, I mean, the NAS is basically promoting blatant misinformation, courtesy of Judge Jones, about intelligent design in this booklet.
So what should our listeners who want to read the other side, download the free NAS booklet, but perhaps understand a little bit more where these misrepresentations are coming in and what in this booklet is just outright false, where can we point them to, Casey?
Well, I wrote a pretty extensive critique of this latest edition, the third edition that's available at discovery.org as well as ideacenter.org, actually, was the original place that it got posted. So if you go to either of those two websites, you can find a full-length critique. I mean, it doesn't hit every problem in the booklet, but it hits a lot of them. In my view, a couple of the most egregious errors, if you don't mind me going into this for just a second,
please,
would be having to do with the fossil record. The NAS, I would say, almost obsesses over a particular fossil called Tiktaalik, which they claim is a transitional form between fish and amphibians. And people who listen to the ID of the Future podcast have probably heard about this fossil before. It is supposedly documenting how fish turned into amphibians. The only problem is that it has a completely fin-like fin that, in my view and the view of some of the other work I've seen, critiques of this, really does not do anything to document the evolution of fins into feet, which you would think would be the most important part of the transition from, you know, fish into amphibians or tetrapods that can walk on the land. So really, this is very interesting because they repeatedly go over and over and over back to Tiktaalik throughout this entire document, when, according to, you know, what I've seen, it's not really a very convincing and compelling example of a transitional form. They also talk about Archaeopteryx a fair amount. Archaeopteryx, you know, has been around for over 100 years, and it's known now that Archaeopteryx's alleged dinosaur ancestors actually are found in the fossil record 20 million years after Archaeopteryx.
I'm laughing because, Casey, this sounds like the same forms and fossils that were used with PBS's teaching materials on evolution. Do you think there's something to that, or?
There might be. There is a lot of similarity. Those who watch the PBS Judgment Day Intelligent Design documentary know that PBS focused intensely upon Tiktaalik and Archaeopteryx. They actually make extensive mention of this fossil Tiktaalik that was actually published after the Kitzmiller versus Dover trial was over, which is quite odd because they were supposed to be reviewing the trial, yet they found this fossil that was, that, you know, came out after the trial was even over. It is very interesting how the same lines and rhetoric that was in the PBS series or the PBS show is in this booklet as well. What's missing from all these discussions of the fossil record is any mention of the fact that the main pattern in the fossil record is one of explosions of biological diversity. Transitional forms are, by and large, the rare exception and not the rule of the fossil record. The rule is that we see mass explosions of new biological diversity, almost always lacking any trace of clear evolutionary precursors. That is what you can, and you can find quote after quote after quote from leading Darwinian evolutionists and paleontologists within the Darwinian paradigm admitting this fact. And so when the scientific elite preach to the evolution, tictalic, this one fossil, and leave out the fact that the rule in the fossil record tends to be explosions of biological diversity, you really get a very clear sense that they are misrepresenting the facts about paleontology and the facts about the fossil record to the public. There is not one single mention of the Cambrian explosion in this entire booklet. That is the defining event in the history of animal life in the fossil record, where nearly all of the animal phyla appear in a geological instant, essentially, without any clear evolutionary precursors. That poses, in my view, and the view of many scientists, a strong challenge to neo-Darwinism. Yet there is not a trace of it in this document. That is because, of course, this document's point is to support evolution, not to challenge it. They aren't interested in discussing, you know, the facts of science. They're interested in pushing evolution to the public. That's why it's very simply to call this propaganda. Another area where I think they really misrepresent the data is with regards to the ability of DNA sequences to construct common ancestry trees or phylogenetic trees. Mm-hmm. You see in this document, they very much push the view that by looking at DNA, we have been able to produce nice, neat, coherent trees of how living organisms are all related to one another. And of course, if you actually study the literature, you find that phylogenetic tree construction is a mess. Trees based upon one gene, one protein, or one macromorphological characteristic very commonly conflict with trees based upon a different characteristic. It's a real problem in tree construction today that you cannot produce a coherent tree of life. As a matter of fact, some scientists are even saying we have to give up the idea that there is a tree of life. Some leading scientists are saying that. So, I mean, really, but you read this booklet and you get the idea that, okay, trees always fit the data. The DNA sequences always put an organism within the tree where it is supposed to go based upon fossils, based upon morphological characteristics. They present this nice, neat, clean picture of common descent when in reality, when you look at the actual papers that are being published, you know, you learn that it's a mess. And a lot of this is discussed in the critique I wrote at ideacenter.org or discovery.org. And a lot of the references are there. And it's worth it to people to not just take the NAS's word for it. People should read this, but don't just believe the pronouncements of the NAS because they said it. That's what they want you to do. They want you to just, you know, believe it because they're trust in their authority. Right. Trust in this argument from authority because this is the top science organization in the U.S., whose biologist membership, by the way, is over 95% atheist and agnostic, according to surveys. Never mind that, though. They want you to trust in their authority, and they want you to believe that they're the unbiased authority on this topic. But don't dig into the rabbit hole, as Mike Jean might say. Don't see how far the rabbit hole goes. Don't look what the evidence actually says. They don't want you to do that. They want you to just trust their assertions in this booklet. And I think when you actually look at what the evidence says, it's very different, and it's much, much messier and much unclearer than what this booklet actually says.
Well, Casey, I think that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for sharing with us on ID the Future. This is Annika Smith broadcasting from the CSC in Seattle. Thanks for listening.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Finn. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.